you know, there's a lot of risk in building something, and that's an existing asset and a great market income producing. So, you know, you've got to put that into context, but we're getting to the point where, you know, valuations are very high right now.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
William Walker is a full-time apartment investor and co-founder of 4M Real Estate Investments. William resides in Nashville, Tennessee, where his primary focus is growing the company's portfolio and new development pipeline. William holds a master's in accounting and a former alumni of Ernst & Young Transaction Real Estate Practice. William, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sam. Proud to be here.
Hey, man, the pleasure is all mine. You know, the same questions I ask everybody who comes on. Can you give us just a brief overview of where you started, where you are now, and how you got there?
Sure. So I started kind of from the ground floor, I would say. My family wasn't in the business and I had no really real estate experience getting started. But my path into the business was more on the analysis side. I, by trade or by training, I was an accountant and got my CPA license after school or during school. After university, I went to work for a company called Ernst & Young and their transaction real estate group. And that's where I say I kind of got my PhD in multifamily. We were working with some of the country's largest real estate investment funds and REITs at the time that were buying large multifamily properties. And I'd also joined a coaching and a networking group around that same time. So I was working on the institutional side and I was working or as a consultant and I was participating as a student of a coaching and a networking group as well. So I would say that's where it all started for me, but started small. My very first piece of real estate was in 2015, and it was a single family rental property that I moved some friends into. And from there, I just got focused, got educated, got around some people that were in the business ahead of me and myself, and found out how I could fit in, add value and partner and ultimately progress and improve the business and take down larger deals.
Right, man. I love that. I love the fact that you were able, you know, you got to see how the big boys played.
That's right. Yeah.
From, you know, from the transaction real estate practice. And then you also got to see kind of the boots on the ground, smaller operators.
Yes.
And even inside of commercial real estate, when you start scaling up that side of your business, everybody else thinks that's big, but for the big boys, it's probably still smaller operators. You kind of got to see it from both sides. Were there any like standout aha moments or things that you went just like, oh, wow, that's really unique in the way that the two differed or anything like that?
Yeah, there was, Sam. So kind of going into that group, I had purchased two single family properties and I had set out with the goal of I'm going to do 100 single family houses. That was kind of my big goal for myself at the time. And I got to two and I'm like, all right, this isn't going to work. I need a new goal. So that led me to apartments. It's more scalable business, but I really came in green to the apartment business. I had some very limited exposure to it just through my own studies and real estate education. But as I moved into EY, the very first client that I was working with, and there was a team of us working on it, was Mid-America. And at the time, they were the largest publicly traded REIT in the country, and they were purchasing Post Properties, which is now all public information. But at the time, it was a 20,000 unit, $3 billion transaction. And I'm first just getting into the apartment kind of world and understanding how these deals get put together, how they're valued, how they're analyzed. So that was just a very expedited education for me in that business. And I saw how all of the institutions we were working with, how they were structuring deals, how they were underwriting, the assumptions they were making, all the way really down to like the LP and the syndication list. And one of the big aha moments for me was several months after I'd been working for EY in that group. I had learned a ton working for them. It's very intense working hours, you know, high demand kind of environment. But when I started working on what you referenced as boots on the ground, I say the same thing. You know, I started seeing a lot of similarities between the two, and it wasn't all that different. I mean, sure, there were large names, much larger transaction sizes, a lot more zeros onto the purchase price. But ultimately, there was a lot of similarities in how they were assessing, valuing, you know, looking at a property from kind of a macro standpoint, looking at rent growth data, population trends, income trends and rent trends, things like that. But that was more of the similarity side of the business. And then kind of where the institutional side stopped was the operations and okay, what does it really take to run this business? And what, you know, what, how am I going to develop my CapEx budget? And, you know, who am I going to have manage this property? So I think from an institutional standpoint, they operated on large data sets. They had access to all the data that they could ever want or we wanted. So we were working with averages, and averages are great when you're looking at a macro level, but once you start getting specific into a market, it only takes you so far. So that was a big key difference and similarity as well between the institutional side that I learned about and then also the boots on the ground side.
What do you mean by that when you say averages only take you so far?
So for example, if I'm trying to underwrite a property and I'm looking at my operating expenses, you know, you might hear that on average, you can run an apartment unit at around $5,000 per door per year. So that's one average that or an assumption that, you know, could be made. And you can drill that into, okay, a property management assumption is going to charge you 3%, or, you know, you might budget repairs and maintenance for, you know, $600 a year a unit. So those kind of assumptions, there's, I think rules of thumb might be a better way to put it, but there's certain rules of thumb based on average aggregate data sets that these institutions will apply because they're buying portfolios. They can't dig into each individual property on a, you know, a 20,000 unit transaction. They've got to take more of a macro data-driven approach to it.
Right. And for them, for whatever, say you were buying one apartment complex, it's going to matter a whole lot if your average, say 600 actually becomes 700, right? That $100 is going
to be absolutely
line. But if you're buying a $3 billion portfolio, maybe what you lose on that 100 on this property, you make up on that 100 somewhere else, and it all just comes out in the wash because it's just
So I think it's just kind of understanding your market with a fine tooth comb and kind of understanding where those variances are from the national averages.
Right. Yeah. And I would think that would also apply as it comes to whatever the class of property you're buying, you know.
Absolutely. So yes, absolutely.
The neighborhood you're in, like all those things,
right,
we who are attempting to scale our portfolios are really going to have to dial in on. That maybe some others can just use it, you know, broad brush.
Yeah. And I got started in Atlanta. You know, a property on one side of Atlanta is going to rent for a lot different than the other side of Atlanta. So if you're just looking at a large city, okay, an institutional level, here's an average rent for, you know, this area of the city. Well, you really got to understand, okay, what are the demand drivers here? Like, why is this property renting for more? And you just don't really get that level of detail until you get boots on the ground and, you know, start walking properties and kind of really understanding those market differentials.
Right. Yeah, I absolutely love that. So when did you move out of Ernst & Young and then go out on your own and go big into apartments?
That was in 2017. I had been working for the firm for about 2 years, going on 2 years at that time. I had two rental properties. I had maxed out a credit card at the time to join my coaching program, which I don't necessarily recommend that strategy to everybody. But for me, I was in a situation in my life where I felt prepared and ready. And, you know, I kind of put myself in a do or die situation. And that was in March of 2017, March 31st, 2017. I walked out of the building and, you know, I was nervous, I was scared to death. I was excited, but, you know, ultimately I had made up the decision in my mind that I could handle failing, trying and failing, but I wasn't okay with not trying. And I had, you know, some of the best education that I think money could buy, both from an institutional like salary standpoint, that was just the benefit of working for that great company. And then also what I had, you know, the stretch I had made from a networking standpoint in that networking group. And over that time period, I built confidence and, you know, I think this is something that I can do. I'm seeing other people that are successful in it. And I took the leap.
Right. I love that, man. I love that, that courage. And I also love the fact that, you know, like you said, you weren't comfortable with having, or you're comfortable having tried and failed. You were not comfortable having never tried. Like that's
absolutely. That was something I wasn't going to be able to live with for sure. And, you know, never looked back and it's worked out for all the better for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So walk us through, you know, what your business looks like today, and then maybe we'll go back a little bit in the story and find out, you know, some of the acquisitions you guys have done and kind of dig into some of that stuff. What does your 4M real estate investments look like today?
Sure. So we actively own and manage a portfolio of about 1,700 units in the Southeast. Those are existing kind of value add assets that we've been purchasing since July of 2018. And then we have 350 units in our new development pipeline in Texas and Nashville, Tennessee.
Okay, man, that's awesome. That's awesome. So let me just get this story right, because March 31st, 2017, you walked out and now you've been building your portfolio since July of 2018. Did it take you that year and 4 months to get a first deal across the line?
It did, Sam. So March 31st, I moved back to Nashville. I moved into one of my rental properties that I owned and had some buddies still living there. So I was able to move back in, and I just started hustling. I was in the real estate investor meetup groups. I was basically talking to anybody that I could find that was involved in real estate in any way, shape, or form. And it certainly wasn't a straight line to the first multifamily property. You know, one of the big kind of memories or catalysts I look back on was a friend of mine. He was running a deals group in a small real estate investors of Nashville group. And he had put together kind of a small investor group that was buying property in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And he kind of took me under his wing, and we got along well through the meeting. But he saw the skills that I had in underwriting property and understanding how these properties were valued, and, you know, the transaction coordination standpoint with the equity and the debt. So he put together a group of five investors, and I went out and I hustled deals in Chattanooga. And I, you know, we were buying portfolios of small little crappy houses that we were paying $30,000 to $40,000 for, putting 10 in and, you know, trying to refinance out. And it was a good little model. I walked some really dirty houses, and I kind of call it character building moments. You know, that 6, 7, 8 months or so, I think I had a peanut butter and honey diet, you know, for most of the year, because I'd left the comfort of my corporate salary, you know, a little bit of money coming in from rental properties that would support my bare necessities, but not a lot of extra cash. And the first multifamily property that I was involved in was a 16 unit property in Cleveland, Tennessee. And it was through this Chattanooga investor group. And I found an off-market deal and, you know, did an assessment on the property and ultimately kind of plugged an investor into that property. And I guess you could say I was maybe a consultant on that deal, but that was really the first apartment complex that I saw that was closed and I had a direct role and benefit from. And that gave me a lot of courage to carry forward. And during that time, also built 8 single family homes with a group here in Nashville, a guy I went to college with. And he actually lived with me in my first rental property coming out of school. So I did a little bit of single family, I guess, investor analysis and trying to help investors buy some portfolios of properties. Got a little 16 unit multifamily done in that time. And we built 8 single family homes in Nashville. But ultimately, you know, I realized that I was kind of getting off course from my original goal. You know, I wanted to buy multifamily. I wanted to syndicate apartments. And I remember I was on a coaching call for one of the coaching mentors that was starting up a program at that time, around that time. And the guy who I had built houses with, you know, wanted to jump on the call and ask me if I would get on. And ultimately, he ended up offering me an acquisitions role with, you know, his firm and company, and to come work with him. So that was kind of the next, I would say, milestone in my apartment journey, and went on to help try and set up an acquisitions program, find off-market properties, you know, establish who we are in the market with the broker base for that company. And, you know, that led me, kind of led me down the path. But in 2018, I met my business partner that I work with today. We had met in 2016 back in Atlanta with that coaching and networking group. So kind of jumping around on timeframes here, but, you know, fast forward through 2017 and some of that grit work in Chattanooga and working with some of these other people trying to help them find property, you know, I kind of drew a line in the sand and, you know, I said, okay, this is my chance to partner with someone that has been in the business and that I provide, you know, I complement their strengths and they complement mine. And from there, that was really where things really started ramping up. And in 2018, we formed that company and that entity. And then about 6 months later was my first deal. And that was a 160 unit apartment complex in Columbus, Georgia. And I sourced that deal through a debt broker who I had a great relationship with. I met a friend of his at a ULI event and they introduced us, but we just stayed in touch pretty much daily, weekly. He was pricing debt for me on properties that I was underwriting and we just communicated, but he called me up one day and said, hey, I've got this buyer that backed out of a deal. I think you'd be interested in it. Do you want me to plug you in with a broker? I said, absolutely. And we ended up putting that deal under contract and closing that deal in July of 2018.
That's awesome. And so then you guys really don't know what 2020 looked like for you, but you guys sound like you went hot and heavy from July of 2018. Like it's getting that first deal done. And then from there, you guys really just seem like you snowballed.
Yeah, it was certainly a lot of momentum, pent up momentum, both from my business partner's previous experience, my previous experience. But we bought a second deal in 2018. It was a smaller distressed asset. And then in 2019, things just really started coming together. We averaged a deal a month in 2019. I think we ended up closing 12 assets in 2019. It was right under 1,500 units. I think it was 1,495 doors that we closed. And it was kind of a wild ride. I mean, we were focused, really, you know, had the horse blinders on, and, you know, all of that momentum just kind of came to fruition in 19. And we really had a solid year and moved into some new markets. We had some sales in 19. So while things seemed to happen quickly and overnight, I think it was slow progression since, I would say, probably 2014 for me, getting to that year to, you know, where I was in a position where I had the education, I had some good experience, I was partnered with the right people, and the market was right. And, you know, when you kind of combine all of those elements, you know, we were able to get some great deals done.
Right. Yeah. And I think those are things that people overlook commonly when they're thinking, gosh, I want to go big, I want to scale, I want to grow. They overlook the years of preparation that goes into a lot of these stories. And I like the fact that we've spent some time, you know, painting or putting some color to your background, because you really did. You put your time in the trenches, hustling 16 unit, you know, complexes in Cleveland down to single family. I mean, I think I've bought plenty of those $40,000 houses. I don't want to do any more.
But absolutely,
those are the battle wounds, your battle scars you take along the way. You go, okay, now this puts me in this position to grow.
So, that's right. I was like a hungry dog, you know, chasing a meal after a lack of one for a week. So it takes focus and determination and grit, but it can happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, man. I love that part of your story. And that's just one of the keys that oftentimes gets overlooked. Absolutely. So let's talk about ground up development. I think that's a fun topic. You guys are building 350 units. How have you done that? And what has kind of been, I guess, your keys with, you know, your developers? How have you found the land? What has been that sale or that pitch to your investors looked like? I mean, talk through us, just kind of give us the fine details on that side of your business now. And why? Let's start there, maybe. So I've asked you like eight questions in a row, but start with why. Okay. Why ground up? And then we'll see if we can remember all the questions I just threw at you.
So the why, I think, has been a progression of the market and where we're at. We're seeing cap rates compress, yields compress. It's becoming more competitive in the value add space, to the point where, you know, we can buy a 70s or 80s product for about the same we can build it for. Now, you know, the key difference there is the land piece, and you've got to find a piece of land to build it. But I think it's really just been, you know, economics driven. And I think, you know, as we've progressed in the business and we've exited some of the older properties, we're looking at newer properties that are in better condition, easier to run. And I think as you mature through the real estate world, you know, similar to what you said, you had bought some of those $40,000 houses as well. You don't want to do them again. Like, that's where I had to start, you know, and it's just been a progression to new construction. Certainly haven't done it all by myself. And I've had some great partners along the way, but I would say, yeah, you know, economic focused and income driven, and just seeing opportunities in the market. You know, we always say that we don't make the market, we just work within the market. And we're seeing some opportunities in new construction. Wall Street Journal came out with an article just a couple of days ago that, based on the data they're seeing, the United States is at a 5.5 million unit deficit based on the demand that we have for housing in this country. So I think that there's opportunity going forward. I think that we have not been building as much as a historical average year to year. And you're seeing these cities like Nashville and Dallas and Austin, Texas, Tampa, Florida, where you've got this massive influx of population, and the demand or the supply isn't necessarily there for the demand that's coming into these smaller cities.
Right. Absolutely. No, you hit it on the head. I love the economics driven viewpoint of it. And also, if you can build something today, you know, you're going to build a brand new asset today for the same price that you can buy a 70s or 80s asset.
Wild. Yeah. I was looking at a property in Nashville, is a early 70s property, and they're pricing it around $120 a door. And, you know, for our vertical costs, we could get really close to that number on an apartment.
Wow.
Less the land. So, but, you know, there's a lot of risk in building something, and that's an existing asset and a great market income producing. So, you know, you've got to put that into context, but we're getting to the point where, you know, valuations are very high right now.
Some risks in building ground up. You mentioned that. What do you see some of those are?
I think the biggest risk in development is your pre-development risk. Once you have your design complete, you've got your financing from a debt and equity side, you know, most of the risk is just your execution on your general contractor. And I think that's, I don't want to say the downhill side of the business, but I think all of the difficulty and the majority of the risk comes from finding the land. And a lot of times you have to put out a significant amount of capital on that land that's not, you know, income generating, right? And you have to put a design plan together to build something. And then you got to go convince a bank that they need to finance 70 to 80%. Then you got to find, you know, your other 25 to 30%. And once you put all that together, your GC, you know, it's kind of off to the races. Let's just foundation, framing, wiring, electrical, you know, go down the list. So I'd say the biggest risk is pre-development.
Right, right. Because let's say you guys are, you know, $250,000 in on maybe even from, you know, earnest money deposits to, you know, getting plans drawn up to all those things. And who knows, a year tied up with meeting with city council, you know, city council, see if you guys can get this thing put through, and then it falls flat.
That's right.
And then you're like, great.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that, you know, your cash is held up or your principal is held up. So that's a big risk. And one of the ways we mitigate that is we like to look for fully entitled deals where, you know, a builder might have, you know, the land is already zoned or entitled for what it is. There may be a preliminary civil or site plan. You know, we like to get involved on the architectural and the design of the vertical. But from there, it's a much less risky project to get involved in. And on all the developments that we're doing, we've been involved kind of after entitlement. So entitlement has been, that risk has been off the table in the deals that we're getting involved in. So we like to work with builders that are local to their area, local experts, boots on the ground, and minimize our pre-entitlement or our pre-development risk.
Right. And I think that's brilliant. You know, I think at some point there's probably an iteration yet again in your business where maybe you'd be willing to take on the entitlement risk. But I think especially starting out, if you can offload some of that onto somebody else's, and you're going to pay up for that. I think that's the other thing.
That's right.
You know, you guys are going to end up paying up for that entitled land, and you're going to pay for that risk that someone else assumed. But in so doing, you're trading that money for not taking on the risk yourself. So
that's right. And it's a progression. I would love to, you know, take down a piece of land and subdivide it and really, you know, put together a plan for it. But I think that's a very advanced real estate play. So, you know, as we get experience and build our Rolodex of contacts and partners in the business, I think we'll be more equipped to do that.
Man, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You've given some awesome tips and pointers on really how to scale your commercial real estate business. And I think that's been a lot of fun. And it's cool just to hear your story and the progress you guys have made. So I look forward to kind of following what you guys are doing here in the future. Let's jump into the final four, William, if we can. First question is that if I gave you just $20,000 to invest in real estate, what would you do with it and why?
Ooh, if I had $20,000 to invest in real estate, I would probably let that money sit and use that money to live off of. And I would go maybe try and wholesale, or I would try and get a deal under contract and find a buyer for that deal that let me participate on the deal, or maybe paid me a fee for the deal and keep kind of rolling that up until I had enough money to maybe put an earnest money deposit down on a larger property, or, you know, be a general partner to the point where I had enough capital that I could contribute to some of those risk costs.
Got it. I love that. I haven't had that answer yet. So that's great. If you could help our listeners avoid one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
I would say be conservative on operating capital going into a deal and making sure you're well capitalized for kind of the unexpected, because you can put together a perfect budget plan for your normal operating expenses, but, you know, you're always going to have unexpected items that come up from operations, especially when you're dealing with some of these older properties. And you need that liquidity and you need that operating capital to get you through those times and make those repairs and not have to come out of cash flow for it.
Right, right. Absolutely. And I've seen either increasing the capital raise be an answer to that, and I've also seen having lines of credit available to cover some of those things.
Absolutely.
Well, that, you know, but either one of those are great answers, because those are things you get stuck. And that's been something people have told us on this show many times, is we didn't raise enough capital. Like, great deal, everything's working out. We had a hiccup and we would have been fine, but shoot, we're out of money.
Yeah. And when you're right, I think that's a very important thing. And from a modeling standpoint, your yield is not going to decrease that much for a few extra, you know, $100,000 or whatever the size of the property is to give yourself a little safety room, right? And then you can always do an ROC to investors if, you know, that money is sitting and you don't need it. So I think it's better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it.
Absolutely. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
We like to give back to different organizations. We've been blessed in our business and have enjoyed some great successes. So I think it's important to give back to the organizations that are important to you. You know, one example I can give just to promote the business more than anything is OUR. It's Operation Underground Railroad. And they have a great mission-driven approach to really to combat sex trafficking in the United States. And it's not a fun topic to discuss or pleasant topic to discuss, but it's real. And I think that's something that everybody can do in their own way and in their own amount and however they, you know, are comfortable giving, but, you know, finding organizations that are, you know, doing the right things and that you're aligned with personally and trying to support those people.
Right. I love that. Last question. If our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
I would say through our website at 4mrei.com, or I'm on social media at Instagram and Facebook. And any of the listeners want to reach out and have some conversations, I'm happy to do so.
That's awesome. William, thanks so much for your time today. I do appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.